Hello and welcome, I'm Luke Burridge, and this is the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. It's the show where I review every science fiction book that I read as I read it, and then I move on to the next one, and I read that one, and I review that one, and I put that one up online, and that's the schedule. Really? Whenever I read a book, there it is. So if you need to know more about me, or want to know more about me, or the podcast, or anything else, just check out the very first episode of the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. You can find that at sfbrp.com on the website, or pretty much wherever you downloaded this podcast, you could probably find episode number one if you look back in the listings a bit. This episode, I might go on a bit longer than I normally plan to. I normally try and get between like 10 and 15 minutes. I can't remember what the original thing is. I always thought it was like between 5 and 10 minutes per podcast, but that was never really realistic. So this one may run a bit longer than maybe 15 minutes. But then again, over the last few weeks, I've been discussing and talking about books that I've read and I really don't like. So I think I should be allowed to talk about a book that I really do like for as long as that. So sorry about the rants over the past few episodes, but I think we should really move on to some good books again. So today I'm reviewing the classic science fiction novel called Dune by Frank Herbert, and it was first published, I think, in 1965, though in some other forms I think it was serialized in some magazines before then. I'm also going to avoid any mention of the books that I've been talking about in the last episode, and the authors there as well. I'm going to discuss this book on its own merits, not as compared to some inferior attempts at the same subject or in the same universe by some other authors. So first of all, let's talk about this universe. Discovering the world and how the factions interact in this world or in this universe and where the power lies and all the politics involved, that's pretty much half the enjoyment of reading this book and discovering it along with the main character of Paul. So I'm not going to go into too much depth about the actual ties between the political factions and stuff. I could actually talk for ages and still not explore it in too much depth, because Frank Herbert's got this funny knack of conveying in one sentence more than you can convey in like a whole page. Like if it was expanded out into a page, you could still explain what was still going on. So much is hinted at and referred to in the book, which isn't actually explored, but you sort of get a feeling for the events. That if you were to write a history book containing everything and all the events that were talked about in Dune, I think the history book would actually run to more pages than the book Dune itself. It sounds strange, but I think that's the main sort of genius, the clever thing about this book. So I'll just go into some of the main points, really, and leave the other ones for you to discover by yourself. Long time in the future, humans have colonized and terraformed lots of different planets around. It's the same as in Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, that it's just humans about. There's no non-human intelligent life out there at all. At one point in this future, humans are enslaved, or they were enslaved in the time of the Dune. It was way in the past. They're enslaved by a machine intelligence and its robot minions. And there's this great battle called the Battle of Corin, and the humans, they win their freedom. And after they win their freedom, there's a law that is passed that no humans can ever use or build again anything called a thinking machine. So that's the first great idea in Dune, in my opinion, that computers don't exist. So Frank has easily sidestepped the big thing that everybody has dropped out or missed out of all of their sort of big predictions in the science fiction books. Everybody talks about space and everyone talks about this and that. Nobody ever talked about the development of the personal computer. But you don't need to in this, because there was a law that passed that there's no computers allowed in the Dune universe. So the result of this is that over many generations, men, humans, are bred and taught and develop their mental capabilities so they can hold masses of information in their minds and compute it all and calculate it. Not everybody can do this, but there's this special sort of caste of people called Mentats, and they are the guys who sort of control information processing in this universe. And then there's spaceflight. And spaceflight isn't controlled by computer either. Instead, there's these people called the Navigators, and the Navigator Guild in the Space Guild, they spend their lifetime developing their mental powers. And they develop it so much that they can sort through billions of possible futures, split-second futures, that is, and then using sort of this mysterious system called the Holtzman Drive, they fold space together at exactly the right split second, and they can take the spaceship safely to where they need to go. It's viewed as some kind of like very, very limited prescience, and all they can see is if they press this button, and if they take like flip this switch and fold space right then, if it's going to work or not, and if it's going to take them to the place or not. So, you know, they keep flicking through space until they need to get where they need to go, and they can do it safely, or that is the idea, and not end up in the middle of a star. So these professions, and many other professions, they all rely on what's known as melange or spice. And spice, it heightens a human mind and the powers of the mind, and it also extends the lifespan of those who take it. And the thing is that spice is very valuable, but it's only found on one planet known as Arrakis, also known as Dune, the title of the book. And, you know, the people who live there call it Dune, at least. I'll talk about more about that in a second. But first of all, a bit about the spice and the rest of the empire. It's so valuable, spices, that the entire economic and political system of the empire is dominated by the supply and demand of the spice. Without it, the empire would literally cease to exist, because, of course, the communications via spaceflight need spice to exist as themselves as well. And the empire, lots of factions, and they're all trying to get in on this spice action. There's the great houses, like the House of Corrin and the House of Harkonnen, and of course Atreides, who Paul, the main hero of the book, he's an Atreides kind of guy. And they each have their own planets and their own armies and their own business interests. And ruling over them is the Emperor, and he has the largest army. And the army is big enough to defeat any single house army, but not all of the houses combined. So there's some kind of balance of power, military power there as well. There's the Chome, I think it's pronounced that, and that's the trading corporation. It doesn't stand alone as a as its own entity. Instead, it's you know, it's each planet, not each planet, each house has got its own sort of like share, its own stake in the company, and its own income comes from Chome. And then there's the Navigators Guild, or the Spacing Guild, that has a monopoly control over moving the spice, because they control all of the spaceships. And then there's other factions like the Seleucid Guard, I think it's called, and the Sardauka, who are the elite fighting forces of the Emperor. And then the Bene Gesserit, who are a female sect who act as diplomats and what's known as truth-sayers. They're lie detectors, in a way, and advisors and historians and concubines and lots of other things as well. And as I said, that is just the start of it. As you read the book, you find out more and more levels of power and levels of influence and feuds and manipulations and rivalries and everything that goes into sort of actually like a very, like say, a well-realized world. You could actually imagine this is the United Nations as you go into it, and it goes down, and then all the petty factions and the nations and everything like that. It's all in there, but very feudal, very sort of medieval in its thinking, in its mindset. And there's a whole caste system, so everyone knows their place, and they don't go above it, they don't go below it at all. The thing is, it gets even more interesting when the action moves to Arrakis. The whole empire, like revolves around spice, and it all comes from Dune. So once you get to Dune, there's more levels of politics and more levels of trading, but now it's not about the spice, because Dune, as the as its name sort of implies, is a desert planet. Spice is all over the place. It's cheap. It's in every food. You eat it all the time, even by accident. But water, that is now the most important thing. So all the political and economic and military power revolves around who has the most water and who can, like, save the water and who can use it best. Not just that, it's around about the desert as well, because the whole planet is a desert. So it's who can move around in the desert with the greatest maneuverability and the best ability to get around. So the space empire is very well rounded, and as far as my reading has gone, it's one of the sort of the most complex political systems in a way. But then the world of Dune itself, the actual planet Arrakis, it stands out easily as one of the greatest examples of what you could call world building in science fiction, where you sort of create a whole world and then play out a story in this world. The background to the novel, of Frank Herbert writing the novel, he actually spent years and years researching deserts and water management and nature and everything like that. He's literally years in the field and, you know, researching and reading papers, and it's obvious that he knows exactly what he's talking about there. It's quite famous that he put in all this time. So there's this sort of before Dune, pre-Dune and post-Dune mindset in science fiction that I've read when portraying planets. Before, planets are just backgrounds for stories. But after Dune, they more and more become the sort of like the environmental effect on the characters, that the planet itself is a character in Dune. And because Dune became one of the best-selling science fiction novels of all time, I think the idea of the planet as a character, you know, sort of other authors couldn't ignore that. So you see it repeated more and more in other books. Sometimes well written, sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtle, but Dune seemed to do it first and better than, you know, better than any book since, maybe, as well. I've never seen such a convincing portrayal of a planet. You know, everything from... Everything has its place. Like, I'm talking from the massive worms, and then there's, you know, the sand that the worms eat. Even the sand has different characters, and there's insect and grass and the mice that jump around. The mouse is, of course, very important in this book. Almost not as important as the great sandworms, which gobble up the sand and gobble up anyone in their path. You know, the mouse is a key to it. But then the planet itself, the shape of the planet and the rocks and the weather and everything ties into the character of the planet. Very, very satisfying. As I said in last week's podcast, you know, and the way it's written, everything, every word on the page seems to come back to the planet of Arrakis, the dune, the dryness of it all. Of course, when I first started reading it, the first time I was reading it, I was thinking, wait a second, there's some problems here. How does a planet with no trees and no oxygen replenishment system in the, like the algae in the ocean, which is a big part of the Earth's ecosystem, how does it resupply the oxygen? And actually, when you finish reading the book for the first time, you think, was that explained? Or that's what I was thinking the first time. And then I thought, yeah, because it's not set out in so many words, this is where the oxygen comes from. Maybe it is in the appendix, but when you finish the book, it's just like you think back to some of the smells that Frank Herbert talks about, and some of the experiences, and some of the things that, you know, a character will just notice out the corner of your eye, and just in that, whole other ecosystems and whole other parts of the ecosystem of Dune as explained just in a small comment or a slight aside, or just a, like I say, just a small observation. The technology in the book, and I'll talk about that for a second, in some ways low technology, because there's no computers to control it. But in another way, it's very high technology, because it's been developed over, you know, thousands of years to be exactly what's needed in every situation. Like the humans have evolved to these mental powers, the technology has evolved to a point where it's just perfect for the job. The best gadgets are those that the Fremen use, the tribes who live out in the deep, deep desert. And they have stillsuits. That's probably the best thing to talk about. The stillsuits is the suits that they wear that cover the whole body, and they're powered by the walking motion of a human, and they can go ages without losing any water, because it recycles the sweat. When you're walking through the desert, you sweat a lot, and it picks up the water and it puts it back into a little pouch, and you can drink that water again. And it takes in your urine, and you can drink your urine again once it's been purified. And even the moisture in your breaths, you breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth. You breathe in through your mouth and out through your nose, and it catches the moisture that comes out of your nose, and you can rebreathe that again. So you can go for literally days or weeks, in fact, without any extra water supplies. You don't have to carry any water, which isn't in your body. So that's a cool thing. Another cool bit of technology I've just written down here in my notes is the shields. And of course, it has a massive impact on the story itself, because the shields are used by the military when they're fighting, and they repel fast-moving objects. So you shoot, you go bang, bullet flies off. You move slowly, and you can pass through a shield when you move slowly. Also, they have lasers, but you can't shoot a laser at a shield, because the shield will blow up and the person inside will be destroyed. But also the person who fires the laser, the energy runs back up the beam somehow. I'm not sure how that works, but and it blows up the person who's shooting the laser as well. So no lasers are used, and you can't fight in space, because the Spacing Guild, the Spacer Guild, they control space travel, so you can't bomb anyone from space. You can't use atomics, because there's like this institutionalized form of, what do you call it, MAD, the mutually assured destruction, I guess it's called. But, you know, so you can't use that, and you can't use long-range firepower. So because of these shields, fighting has gone down to hand-to-hand combat, or not hand-to-hand, but, you know, man-on-man combat using swords and trying to penetrate the shield in slow motion to then kill the person inside the shield. The thing is that when you get to June, it's flipped on its head again. So it's set up like this in the first few chapters. As soon as you get to June, shields don't work very well because there's too much sand in the air and there's too much static electricity in the winds and the movement of air past it with the sand. And also, the shields attract the worms, and these worms are massive. They can swallow like 100 men in one gulp, and so you really don't want to turn your shields on when you're out in the desert. So the whole balance of power that's been set up for thousands of years with a fighting force that uses shields, put them on Dune, and suddenly it's all flipped on its head. And believe me, there is a lot of fighting on Dune, so that whole thing gets explored quite well. So you really get a feel of the richness of the whole world. That's all I want to talk about there. I might as well get a bit into the story. I'm going to tell you the whole story in 100 words. So here we go. Paul Atreides, young hero. His father is the Duke of House Atreides. He's given control of Arrakis, of Dune, by the Emperor. And it sounds like a good deal because this is where all the spice comes from, but it just puts him in a very, like, a big position of weakness. His family is double-crossed, and then the House Harkonnen, the main evil baddies, they come in, take over. His father is killed. Paul escapes with his mother into the desert. They live in the desert for a while with the Fremen, and then Paul grows up and he becomes a leader in the Fremen community, let's say, and then he takes his forces and assaults the combined forces of the Harkonnen house and of the Emperor, and takes control of Arrakis again, but not just of Arrakis, also takes control of the whole empire by sort of forcing the marriage, or his marriage, to the eldest daughter of the Emperor, who happens to be there at the time. And it, you know, I can't really be accused of spoiling the book here, because as soon as you start reading the book, at the beginning of every section, at the beginning of every chapter, Frank Herbert has written a little passage, which is, like, nominally written by a character in the book, but written after the events in the book have taken place. So they're clips, mainly they're clips of the histories written by the daughter of the Emperor, and her histories mainly of her time with Paul and Paul's battles and the time in her father's house. I think "In My Father's House" is one of the names of the history. So right from the start, you know that Paul is going to win. And of course he's going to win, because it's a book about him. And in these books, kind of books, the hero normally wins at the end. Well, not normally. You could read an Ian M. Banks book, but, you know, that's the way it is. But it's not just the major plot points that are given away. There's some, like, other plot points given away, like who the person is that betrays the family in the opening chapters, in the opening act of the book. So I can't really be accused of giving anything away there, but, you know, that's not where the joy of reading the book is. It's not in the main plot points. It's not in the main plot arc through the book. It's actually discovering the smaller plot points, the subplots, the motivations behind the characters, and discovering the world. And mainly also is how the world affects and guides the plot every single step of the way. And also the subtlety of the writing is fantastic. Frank Herbert introduces, in the very first few pages of the whole book, he introduces the ideas that, you know, the key to the main conflict at the end, and how Paul will defeat his greatest enemy in the last three pages of the book, is set out in the first three pages of the book. You don't get it the first time you read it through, but the second time you just go, yeah, of course. And it's not just one conflict at the end, which is also revealed in the very beginning, but in a subtle way. There's a few. I'm not going to go into them now here, of course. So far, I've talked about the things that I really like about the book, but I've left out of this review, in this discussion, all the things that I really love about the book, because the best thing about them is discovering them for yourself. One thing I really like is the small incidents where, you know, Paul discovers things about himself or about the world, and you discover them at the same time. Like Paul's father, Leto, he's telling Paul how he hopes that Paul will one day become a Mentat. And Paul just says, no, I can't become a Mentat, because you've got to start training when you're really, really young, and you've got to be trained and conditioned pretty much from birth to become a Mentat. And you can't be told that you're going to be trained either, because it'll affect your training. And then he sort of tails off, and you realise he's describing himself. He has been trained from birth, but he hasn't been told that he's been trained from birth until he's told, and you find out with him. It's a really nice moment. And those kind of things happen throughout the book. It's the self-discovery by the characters, and it's all it all weaves back into the story. The characters themselves are pretty well realised, the main characters anyway. The supporting roles aren't quite so satisfying. They have well-rounded histories, but sometimes the motivations, you know, I don't really understand why they're doing stuff. But then maybe it's just because the world is so complex that I've just missed stuff in the times I've read this book. The other thing that I don't like is that the characters have, like, two names each, at least two names, sometimes three names each. They have a first name and a second name, but when you're first introduced to them, you're introduced by just one. Then later they're referred to as another name. And then, you know, so you've got to put the names together in your head. And then they're sometimes referred to by their name, but sometimes by a title or a rank or by their nickname, or, like, some characters have, like, a private name that they call each other. Even in the name Dune, the planet is also called Arrakis, or Arrakis is called Dune. And Paul, his name Paul Atreides, but as soon as he gets, you know, he hooks up with the Fremen, they give him, like, another three names straight away and a title, and then he's got his prophetic name and all this kind of stuff. It might be, though, because this actually does tie in, I say it might be, this is there's some reasons for this. The names, the confusion between the names that I had reading the book, that the guys who fight with Leto, Paul's father, some of them have got, like, not similar names, but I did confuse them at some point. But that actually takes place later on in the book by the characters. They think there's two different characters because they've got two different names, but it ends up being the same person. And I'll just say, I'm not going to spoil it, but it happens more than once in the book. What else? Oh, yeah, the romance. There's some romance in the book. Not a lot of it, though. Paul pretty much, he sort of gets together with the first girl that he meets in the desert. But then even the way that he does that, he almost does it all, like, accidentally. And the way he does it reveals so much about the Fremen just in that small exchange that happens. He just says, oh, can you hold this for me? And then suddenly it just reveals so much about the culture just in that one exchange. And I guess the other romance is maybe between Jessica, Paul's mother, and Leto, his father. There's a key thing that she does for her husband out of love, which at the beginning you don't really think much about, but soon you realise it's got major effects on the entire galaxy there. Well, not the galaxy, on the Empire, especially on Dune itself. So I really enjoyed the way that Frank Herbert, this is the key thing, he can portray so much in a single line. At other times, though, the writing style, it feels like it drags on a bit, especially sort of like towards, like, about three quarters of the way through the book, you just think, maybe not. Like, at the end, at the beginning of the last quarter of the book, I just feel you could get on with it. He's going over the same issues again and again in the character's head, and it feels like you're stuck in the head sometimes, and I just want the pace to pick up a bit there. My other issue, and this is the main issue that I have with this book, it's not a huge issue, but like I say, if this is the worst thing I can say about it, it's that some of the characters, they have these mental abilities that seem to just be a little bit too advanced for our current understanding of the laws of nature and the laws of science I'm just saying that I'm definitely someone who prefers science fiction that stays more in the realms of science rather than crossing over into the sort of mystical areas. You know, where you can know stuff that you can't know. You know, that you can't observe. Humans can't observe stuff in the past or in the future, or that's far away, or that's in the minds of others. You know, there has to be some explanation of how they know this. Frank Herbert, he does try and explain it to a certain extent. One, Paul is a product of hundreds of generations of selective breeding, which is a key thing in the story. And also, he's had this Mentat training, so he's almost a human computer. So, you know, how do you know what he can know and how he can deduct things and he can know stuff about other people just by looking at them and just observing them for 1 second? I don't know. But then he's got these visions of the future that are really unreliable as well. You think, is this actually going to take place? He sees himself die time and time again, and then maybe he has lots of visions, or he has one vision, but then through his superior mind or knowledge and his skills, he instinctively brings things, or maybe knowingly brings things into line with what he's envisioned. So maybe the visions of the future aren't real visions of the future. And that's, again, one of the big themes of the book, is sort of like, you know, human determinism versus fate and how you can get around that, I guess. The only thing that I think that he misses a beat on is the whole idea of genetic memory, which is how memories can pass from a mother to a daughter in the DNA. I don't know where genetic, the knowledge on genetic engineering and all that kind of stuff was in 1965 and how much we knew about it, but I'm sure we knew that there's just not enough space in the human genome to contain like massive amounts of recorded experience for generations in the past. So, you know, the idea of how someone born with this knowledge and how they'll get through in life, and you already know everything you need to know when you're born, that is actually explored in the book as well, quite well, but I just didn't really like that thread. Thankfully, this sort of metaphysical leanings of the book, they don't have any more major influence on the plot than any of the other aspects of the book. Unlike many other books, of course, where suddenly this character, he suddenly can see into the future, or he can suddenly read a mind, and he gets them out of a fix, and then they move on. Normally I talk a lot about the action in a novel, but I've gone on way, 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 way too long about this already, so I'd just like to say it is exciting material throughout the book. Every conflict has its reason and has its consequences. The themes of the book, very quickly on this, religion, covered quite nicely, fate, destiny, all of that kind of stuff, I just mentioned that before, that's mentioned, morality and ethics. The two biggest themes, though, I think, they actually stand out more now that I read it, more than when Frank Herbert was probably writing it back in the 1960s. First of all is like the collapse of an empire, how it becomes decadent and then becomes vulnerable to its previous colonies and especially other entities outside the empire and within the empire with less technology, you know, and the whole thing about like fighting a resource war as well. You know, if someone in power in Washington or in Westminster could have read this book in 2003 or 2002, 2001 time, you know, it has everything that you need to know about fighting a war against a local population, trying to subdue it and win them over, and they've got like a religion of their own, and also a big thing is that their code of ethics treats suicide attacks as pretty much an acceptable way of warfare, and you know, it's all that kind of research. Yeah, it's all there. Another big theme is, of course, living in harmony with the world and the ecology there as well. You're only ever like a small few degrees away from massive change. In the Book of Dune, the Fremen, they especially set out in the appendix that they decide to take the planet and make it better for human existence. It's not going to do them any good, but their like great grandchildren, they're going to get the benefit, and they decide to work at it and make it better. And back here in the real world, I guess human actions, we're changing the climate all the time. Probably, I can only guess that it's not going to be good for our great-grandchildren, but we've still not made that decision to just, you know, do anything about it. I know I don't do enough about the environment. Sounds bad, but I might as well admit it. On that note, I think that's everything that I've got here in the notes. Again, I have gone way, way too long on this. Maybe I'll record it again on a shorter version. But those are my thoughts on Dune. Well, not all my thoughts. As I said, I could go on for a lot longer, especially if I'm talking to someone else who knows the book and likes the book. I could go on for hours. But I think I've done everything that I've talked about a lot, but I really haven't spoiled it. I've left out so much of the book that you can discover by reading it by yourself. So if you haven't read it yet, I'm giving this book 4.5 stars out of 5, which means go out, buy it, read it. You don't need to buy it new because it's like the best-selling science fiction novel of all time, so you can pick it up secondhand. If you have read it before, 4 out of 5 stars means you should probably read it again because you can still get more out of it. Maybe after my sort of passionate review here about the book, you'll get more out of it. I'm not giving it 5 out of 5 stars because, you know, well, it's a book, it's 40 years old, it does stand up surprisingly well, but there are, I said, the slower sections in it, and some of the things that it didn't quite sit right in my mind about it. Some questions, which, maybe it's just because it's so complex, I didn't get all the questions answered that I really wanted. And also, in a way, by the end of the book, I don't really like Paul Atreides anymore, the main character, I just don't like them by the end. So, but that's actually like quite a confidence set for an author of Frank Herbert's caliber. It's just the whole book, brilliantly realised world, and it's just as convincing now as it ever was, and probably just as inspiring and influential as it ever was. So, that's it. Next book that I'm going to read is Ken MacLeod's book called Learning the World. It's a more recent book. Can't remember when it was written, but it is one of his more recent books. I read another book of his called Cosmonaut Keep, and while I don't remember much about it or much about the story, I remember that I enjoyed it. I also just discovered that it's part of a series of 3, so I might go back, read that book again, and then continue in the trilogy. But next week is a book I actually just started reading it, and it's quite good so far. Ken MacLeod's Learning the World. Email me if you've got anything to share, any book suggestions for your future, or anything that you want to talk to me about Dune, anything like that. I know the chances are that you're not listening to this now as I release it, this podcast. You're probably listening in my future. in 2010, 2012. But even then, email me. I'm sure my email address will still be valid then. Luke@juggler.net. And that's it. Thanks a lot. Thanks for sticking with it. I've gone 30 minutes now. Catch you later. See you next week or next episode or whenever it's going to be.